Watch Scrolling for July 22nd, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
We are back again with another more. There's still more stories of Sherlock Holmes. This is Chapter 2 of The Valley of Fear.
And I feel like the chapter title tells it all. Sherlock Holmes discourses. So now...
why does he have to diss anything? He disses Watson.
So here's a chapter where Sherlock Holmes is going to tell you stuff. Sit back and enjoy, my friends.
That's exactly what we get here. Yeah. Well, we need to set the stage, right? This is
absolutely.
This is really well done introduction absolutely. To the characters that we need to know about and to the case.
So recall from chapter one, which was only 2 days ago for us, but which would have been a month ago for the readers of 1914, we have ended with Mr. Douglas being horribly murdered at Burl House Manor. So now, opening of the new chapter. It was one of those dramatic moments for which my friend existed. It would be an overstatement to say that he was shocked or even excited by the amazing announcement. Without having a tinge of cruelty in his singular composition, he was undoubtedly callous from long overstimulation. Yet, if his emotions were dulled, his intellectual perceptions were exceedingly active. There was no trace, then, of the horror which I myself felt, his curt declaration. But his face showed rather the quiet and interested composure of the chemist who sees the crystals falling into position from his oversaturated solution.
Yes, we've got quite a mystery here, and we've got Sherlock Holmes being the, I'm going to be a scientist, and I'm going to notice things, and I'm not going to react here.
So he's going to be talking to Inspector McDonald. Can we just pretend like he's being played by Scotty from Star Trek?
Ooh, I like that. Yes.
I was thinking more like Kevin McDonald from Kids in the Hall, but that's okay, fine. That would be a much more fun character, as frenetic as he is.
And it's funny because Inspector Mac is like, why aren't you more surprised? And Holmes is like, well, like an informant told me this guy was going to be killed, and now he has been killed, so...
That's okay. How things go sometimes in the mystery biz.
Right? A little nonchalant here.
Holmes has already told Inspector Mac all about Moriarty, apparently. Which is kind of interesting, since he didn't bother to tell Watson.
Watson's on a need-to-know basis.
Inspector McDonald smiled and his eyelid quivered as he glanced toward me. I won't conceal from you, Mr. Holmes. Oh, I'm sorry. Should I do the Scotty voice? I won't conceal from you, Mr. Holmes, that we think in the CID that you have a wee bit of a bee in your bonnet over this professor. I made some inquiries myself about the matter. He seems to be very respectable, learned, and a talented sort of man.
Why are you reading this like it's like The Simpsons and it's the gentleman who takes care of the school?
He's from Aberdeen. That is the Aberdeen accent. That's exactly where that comes from.
I'm giving her all she's got there, Captain.
Yeah, but I think that Inspector McDonald, he's a little bit, like, unsure how to talk about this with Holmes, because he respects Holmes, but he also thinks, like, maybe there's not so much evidence against this professor. And he says he himself really enjoyed talking to this professor, and he actually learned a lot about eclipses when he visited Moriarty's office, and Moriarty pulled out a globe and a reflector lantern and showed him exactly how eclipses work. Good professor. And so,
teaching Holmes moment. Says, some guy shows right. up and says, hey, how does an eclipse work, professor? And you go, okay, let me explain. Here's the light from the sun. I would love to see that scene.
First, you go to Southern Illinois University and you look up at the right time, but don't look correctly.
And then good luck trying to get home because the traffic is awful because everybody's driving north.
We're speaking of the eclipse from a couple years ago. Sorry.
Indeed. McDonald, though, he didn't go in thinking they were going to talk about the eclipses. He doesn't really know how they got onto that subject, in fact. And so Holmes guesses that Moriarty had Mac sitting in front of the desk so that Mac was all lit up while the professor was in relative darkness.
Oh.
And McDonald does confirm that that is indeed exactly how it went down.
He's a criminal mastermind, this Moriarty.
And then Holmes asks, oh, did you notice that painting behind the professor's desk? Oh, sure. Yeah, McDonald did notice a nice painting, but doesn't really know what that has to do with anything.
Holmes says, all knowledge comes useful to the detective. Even the trivial fact that in the year 1865, a picture by Greuze entitled La Jeune Frère Rurier.
I don't think that's how you pronounce it, Steve.
How do you say it in French, Pam?
A picture by Greuze entitled La Jeune Fille à l'Agneau fetched 1,200,000 francs, more than 40,000 pounds, at the Portalis sale. May start a train of reflection in your mind.
Hmm.
So basically, that picture that just looked like a picture to Mac, that's actually a super valuable piece of art. And how in the world is a math professor going to afford that, asks Sherlock Holmes.
And this is, so we're going to get three statements on money during this chapter. And each one kind of gives you an idea. So what we have right here is we have 40,000 pounds for a painting that gets related to how does a math professor who makes 700 pounds a year afford such a luxury? Obviously, there's a challenge there. And then the third one will come up in a little bit, and we'll talk about that.
But wait, Pam, how does Sherlock know that this painting is in this office?
Well, Holmes has been in Moriarty's rooms 3 times.
But he's never met Moriarty, is what he says. He's only snuck into his rooms and snooped around. Isn't that interesting?
It is.
Know thy enemy, Steve.
Yeah, that is, that's a thing. But he still has never explained to Watson about Moriarty. In fact, in the final problem, which was published in 1893, Watson still had never heard of Moriarty.
And that's probably a continuity error on the part of Doyle. I mean, he's writing a whole 20 years later now, right? It's 1914. He's setting this before the final problem, and he can't go back and change the final problem, but he wants to use Moriarty. So what are you going to do, right?
Yeah, I think that this is certainly something that we can excuse. Doyle wanted a perfect foil to Sherlock, and the perfect foil was already written in 1893. Bring Professor Moriarty back and put him back in here. And we can excuse the fact that this is again, Watson's never heard of him, but he's the spider behind all of the crime lurking in London.
I think Watson suffers from short-term memory loss. I don't know why.
As far as you remember.
As far as I remember.
And yeah, Doyle really likes that spider metaphor for Moriarty, right? He uses it in the final problem. He uses it again here. He has dozens of exiguous threads, which lead vaguely up towards the center of the web, where the poisonous, motionless creature is lurking. And that spider as mastermind, that's really central to a lot of pop culture.
So in fact, let's bring this down to, you know, for the everyday person who may not be the scholar on Sherlock Holmes, those Spider-Man readers probably recognize the Kingpin as the mastermind behind many of Spider-Man or Daredevil's challenges. And he hires all the other bad guys to do all the stuff that become the foils for these superheroes. But Kingpin just always seems to be in the background, never really the person to pin the problem on.
Yeah, you're right. That works really well as a metaphor that I understand. Thank you. Holmes, here's another metaphor that I really understand. Holmes really likes to give out homework in this story.
Well, And it's funny because he's really acting like a mentor, right, to young Inspector Mac. And so Holmes starts speaking about Jonathan Wilde. He asks him, hey, have you heard of Jonathan Wilde? No, I haven't. Oh, he's from 1750 or thereabouts. And Inspector Mac is like, not that impressed. He's like, well, you know, I'm a practical man, he said. I'm not really looking for history. And so then Holmes actually says, Mr. Mac, the most practical thing that you ever did in your life would be to shut yourself up for 3 months and read 12 hours a day at the Annals of Crime. Everything comes in circles. And so he has this idea that, you know, one of the problems that Inspector Mac has, and I think by extension, the police system has, is people don't study the history of crime. People don't look at how every crime has been committed somewhere. People aren't scientists about it.
And he extends that metaphor of everything comes in circles when talking about Professor Moriarty. He explains that Jonathan Wilde was the hidden force of the London criminals to whom he sold his brains and his organization on a 15% commission. The old wheel turns and the same spoke comes up. It's all been done before and will be again. So say we all. Pam, do you get that reference?
No.
Oh, I thought you giggled in such a way that I thought you got that one. That is Battlestar Galactica.
Oh,
everything that has been done before,
yes,
has will be again.
I knew that it was, yes, in the back of my mind. I couldn't get it to the front. Yes. I'm ready to rewatch Battlestar. But
so are we. That's a third show we're gonna start.
Should do that.
Oh dear.
I'll watch it.
Oh
together.
Dear.
And Holmes even goes further than that, and he says, sometime when you have a year or two to spare, I commend to you the study of Professor Moriarty. So he really makes it clear, like, it's not a small business, the study of criminology. You gotta have the time and space to do it.
And yeah, you know, a sabbatical at this point in your life is probably the right thing to do.
Do policemen get sabbatical?
Maybe not.
3 months to work on the Annals of Crime and a year or two just to study Moriarty. Wow, that's a lot of work that he's putting on this guy.
So let's come back to something. We're going to get another reference to the salary of Colonel Sebastian Morin and what Moriarty pays for him. So what we have is that, if you remember, the professor gets about £700 a year. So what does Moriarty pay?
£6,000 a year. And the quote is really interesting. He says, that's paying for brains, you see. The American business principle. I learned that detail quite by chance, but it's more than the prime minister gets.
So you're saying that crime certainly pays in Moriarty's world.
I've heard the opposite. I've heard that crime doesn't pay.
Well, you talk to the prime minister.
That's so cute. Sorry.
Oh, you humble, humble schmuck.
After this discussion, where Sherlock Holmes discourses at some length, he turns to the matter at hand, the matter that ended chapter one. He says to Mac, then how did you get at Mr. Douglas and the fact that he had been horribly murdered? That was in the enclosed official report. It didn't say horrible. That's not a recognized official term. It gave the name John Douglas. It mentioned that his injuries had been in the head from the discharge of a shotgun. And so you see here, Inspector Mac, he's a real police guy, right? He's like, well, I didn't say, he did say horrible, but he's like, oh, I didn't write that in my report. Don't worry. I'm just guessing, shot in the head with a shotgun. It's pretty horrible.
Yeah.
It strikes me, you guys, that this is one of the chapters where we probably get the very least of Watson that we're ever going to get. This is just Watson, like, basically acting as a newspaper reporter, taking down the dialogue between Sherlock and his new mentee, Inspector McDonald.
Well, we've learned he's really important to help Sherlock think if he just stands there. It doesn't move too much.
He's not important to the introduction of all of the concepts. Yeah. He's important to the middle part where Sherlock needs to think. Good point.
And Watson does not, in fact, need to hear all of these things, all of the discourses on how you solve crimes. That's something that Mac needs to hear. So what brings us to the ending of the chapter. Then, with your permission, says Holmes, we will leave it at that, Mr. Mac. The temptation to form premature theories upon insufficient data is the bane of our profession. I can see only two things for certain at present. A great brain in London and a dead man in Sussex. It's the chain between that we are going to trace.
What a great ending. Isn't that pretty perfect? For if I'm going to sell you a piece of a story monthly, I am setting out, here's the case, I am going to find the chain between that we are going to trace. That's excellent work.
And it's two for two so far. Chapter one ended with this wonderful ending that certainly set up this chapter. And this chapter is leading us right into chapter three. I can't wait.
It's unfortunate that this is the last novel from Doyle that was published this way, because I think he's really found that cliffhanger ending writing style.
Yes, I totally agree with that. And because this novel, you know, it's in two parts, very much like A Study in Scarlet, it is partially based on and drawing upon the American dime novel tradition. So cliffhanger endings is a real staple, and we can see him drawing upon that throughout this.
You never know. Maybe they'll use it in a serial form in the movies.
This is awesome. I'm so glad that we're reading through this. I'm so glad that we are going through this adventure. And boy, Pam, I got to tell you, I can tell how much you love this story already.
I love this story.
So hopefully everybody else is loving it as much as you are and enjoying going through this tale with us. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text, send us an email, follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes, and go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for all of these conversations. It's going to get fun in chapter three tomorrow, isn't it?
It sure is.
Dun, dun, dun. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore, welcoming you to the Valley of Fear.
But your internet is still better than my French.
And my French is almost non-existent.